The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Good evening, everyone, and thanks so much for joining us at the Free Library of Philadelphia at Home. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Architecture critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer for more than 20 years, Inga Safran has won the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for her sagacious critiques of urbanism, planning, and Philly's hyper-rapid transformation. An Inquirer writer since 1985, she worked as the paper's suburban reporter and Eastern European correspondent, served as the Loeb Fellow at the Harvard University Graduate School of Design in 2012, and in 2018, she was awarded the prestigious Vincent Scully Prize by the National Building Museum. Becoming Philadelphia is a collection of some of her most compact and insightful columns over the years, and I have to say the intro alone is worth the price of admission. Inga, the screen is all yours.
Thank you so much, Andy. As much as I wish I was giving this talk in the library's vaulted auditorium designed by Julian Abel and Horace Trumbauer, it's still wonderful to see, well, I'm not really seeing, but the idea of seeing so many readers through the screen. I don't know about you, but I feel like I've lived a year in these last 3 months. Can you go to the next slide, Andy? The pandemic has completely altered the way we inhabit Philadelphia and relate to its buildings, its streets and parks. And the anti-racism protests have further reconfigured our relationship with our surroundings by forcing us to confront the structural inequities that underpin every aspect of the built environment. The world will never be the same. Unfortunately, all this makes my book, Becoming Philadelphia, feel a bit like a relic from a bygone era. I knew, of course, when I submitted the manuscript to my editor 18 months ago, that we would have moved on to new concerns by the time it appeared between two covers. That's how it is with printed things these days. The Twitterverse and the 24-hour news cycle churns through news and ideas so fast that it's impossible for books to keep up. I just could never have imagined how different things would be. But what's happened over the last 3 months has not made Becoming Philadelphia any less relevant, just the opposite. I always meant for this collection to reflect the history of our moment. It turns out it is now a history of the past. And we need to understand the past to make sense of the present. So let me take a step back. 2 very long years ago, I was approached by Micah Clyte, the editor of Rutgers University Press, a native Philadelphian and a longtime reader. He suggested that I should collect the best of my columns for a book. Now, I'll admit, I was a little dubious. Journalism is not merely the first draft of history. It's the draft you often want to toss in the trash and forget. My columns are typically pegged to some news event, either something that is about to happen or something that has just happened. Their shelf life is very short. Why, I wondered, would anyone want to read something that I wrote in 2001 in 2020? When I was in college working on my school newspaper, we all wore t-shirts that cynically declared, "Tomorrow's fish wrap today." Of course, I wasn't about to turn down a book offer. I wrote my first column in 1999, a few months after I moved to Philadelphia to become the Inquirer's architecture critic. It was quite an abrupt turn for me career-wise. I had spent most of the 90s overseas working as a foreign correspondent for the Inquirer, first in Yugoslavia, then in Moscow. I know it's hard to imagine in 2020 that the Enquirer once supported a staff of reporters based in foreign countries, but it's true. During my years abroad, I covered two wars and witnessed the destruction of two great multicultural cities, Sarajevo and Grozny. It was painful to watch these agglomerations of history and human accomplishment reduced to rubble. The experience left me with a deep desire to write about how we treat our own cities. And I felt the Enquirer's coverage specifically and newspaper coverage generally had focused too heavily on the business side of real estate development and not enough on planning and design or how government decisions shape neighborhoods. Having watched Philadelphia and other cities do a lot of damage to themselves with highways, parking, demolitions of historic buildings, and bad design, I was eager to shine a light on how decisions about the city's form were made. The next image, please. The city's demolition of the Ridge Avenue Farmers Market, shown in this Vince Feldman photo, was typical. Even though it was a national historic landmark, the highest federal designation, this handsome Victorian building by Davis Supley was casually raised in 1997. There was no debate about its design merits, what the building meant for North Philadelphia, or what the city would do with the vacant lot after it was torn down. Gentrification ultimately caught up with the neighborhood, and a small apartment building was under construction the last time I went by the site. What an asset a food market would have been for the neighborhood. You can substitute a different building and a different neighborhood, and the outline of that little story could be the basis for any number of columns I've written over the last 20 years. My weekly column took its current form about a year after I returned from Moscow, when it was christened Changing Skyline. Since then, it has appeared every Friday in whatever the Enquirer happens to be calling its features section. So don't ever try to reach me on Tuesday and Wednesday, because that's when I'm assembling the words and photos. I file my column late Wednesday, then come Thursday morning, I begin the cycle all over again, calling sources, going to meetings, researching history, collecting photographs. Anyway, once I wrap my head around doing this collection, I started reading through my old columns, and more than 1,600 of them. Figuring out which columns to choose wasn't as easy as I thought it would be. Obviously, I wanted to include the best written ones, but I also wanted the columns to tell a larger story. I made it a short list of 300 or 400 columns, and I printed them all out. And then I started putting them in piles. And as I grouped them together, themes started to emerge. I jettisoned some of the lesser columns and I reorganized the piles. The entire floor of my office was covered with stacks of paper. And after a while, it became clear that my 20 years as architecture critic had coincided with a period of really profound change in Philadelphia. For decades, the city had been losing population, losing jobs, losing tax revenue, losing relevance and political power. And then all of a sudden, everything changed. My 1,600 columns represent a timeline of Philadelphia's transformation. A spotty one, full of gaps, but a timeline nonetheless. It would be impossible to include every piece, so I finally got the book down to 80 columns. And I think of it as a kind of a book of snapshots. The organization isn't strictly chronological, and not every major event is represented. But my hope is that together, they will help people understand Philadelphia's current boom is a recent and still fragile phenomenon. The next slide, please. For reasons that we are only beginning to understand, Philadelphia began to put itself back together in the 90s and the early 2000s. Gradually, the exodus of residents stopped and the city started to build again. For people who've only recently settled in Philadelphia, The last decade may seem like a nonstop party of restaurant openings and festivals, construction and cultural expansion. This has indeed been the longest, most sustained period of city building in Philadelphia since the early 20th century, when immigrants and Black Southerners poured in to work in the city's factories. The new buildings and parks that have been built in this period have transformed Philadelphia in wonderful ways. Next slide, please. I know that vibrant is a much abused word in urbanist circles, but it's astonishing to see how many people were out on the streets last weekend in the midst of the pandemic, picnicking in the city's parks, walking dogs, biking, jogging. It's not just affluent places that have benefited from the new energy either. Neighborhoods that were dependent on overpriced corner stores have seen the arrival of modern supermarkets. New public schools have been built throughout the city. Next slide, please. At the same time, we know that the improvements have been starkly unequal. The changes that have made Philadelphia successful and livable for its middle class have also made it more fraught and uncertain for low-income residents. Next slide, please. So how do we assess what happened to Philadelphia during these last two decades? Is it a success story or a tragedy, or maybe a bit of both? I don't think you can properly answer that question without fully understanding what the city was like before the boom. Next slide, please. I want to take you back to 1999. That was the year the city finally tore down One Meridian Plaza, a 70s office building on the south side of City Hall. The tower had been destroyed 8 years earlier in a fire that completely gutted the upper floors. At the time, it was the worst high-rise fire in America. Three Philadelphia firefighters died trying to put out the blaze, which also ruined half a block of Chestnut Street and seriously damaged the beautiful marble Girard Trust building. Next slide, please. A few months after the fire in 1991, I left Philadelphia to cover the war in Yugoslavia. Over the course of the 90s, I would return to the city briefly. I had a baby, I went overseas again, this time to Moscow. All the while, the burned out hulk of the Meridian stood there, untouched, glaring down at City Hall, a symbol of Philadelphia's decline. When I returned from my posting in Moscow 7 years later in 1998, the charred, empty tower was still there. It wasn't until the following year that its owners finally began demolition. New slide, please. There were other signs of change that year. 1999 was the year that the first version of the 10-year property tax abatement was introduced. And coincidentally, it was also the year that the city imploded the MLK Towers, the dilapidated and much reviled public housing project at 12th and Catherine, a mere 10-minute walk from City Hall. Two dozen public housing towers would soon be yanked from the skyline like rotten teeth, and the neighborhoods rebuilt at lower densities. I'm not going to argue that these brutal, soul-crushing towers were worth saving, yet I do think it's worth noting that the city began removing these enclaves of poverty at the exact same moment that it was shifting its resources into middle-class housing through the abatement. Both decisions got us to where we are today. I don't want to imply that 1999 was a specific turning point. As I say in my introduction, history doesn't move in a straight line, it lurches. But it's possible to see the late 90s as an inflection point, much as 2020 is likely to end up as one as well. Just as it's difficult to pinpoint the moment of Philadelphia's turnaround, it's also hard to identify the moment of its decline. In the first decades of the 20th century, Philadelphia proudly called itself the workshop of the world. Midvale steel turned out raw material for the nation's industrial turbines. The Bud Company assembled train cars and automobiles, and workers at the Navy Yard fashioned steel plates into mighty ships. The city had tens of thousands of good-paying working-class jobs, a vibrant downtown, and renowned cultural institutions. The city continued to grow into the 1950s, actually. To satisfy the demand for modern housing, developers plowed through farms to create the neighborhoods of the Great Northeast. And yet there were indications that all was not well. Even while the city was expanding at the edges, the neighborhoods in the center, like this one in Tioga section, next slide, please, were beginning their slow, painful slide. Suburbanization would take the city's residents, deindustrialization would take its jobs. Once a city of 2.2 million, Philadelphia had shriveled to less than 1.5 million by the 90s. A lot of people think of the 60s as the worst decade, but it was really the 70s when Philadelphia hit bottom, hemorrhaging 140,000 jobs and 13% of its population. Only the cities of Baltimore and Detroit lost a greater percentage of their residents. Midvale Steel closed in 1976, the year Philadelphia celebrated the nation's bicentennial. Bud was subsumed into an international conglomerate in 1978. Dozens of small manufacturers went under. As I said, history doesn't move in a straight line, it lurches. And even as the city shed industrial jobs, Philadelphia saw the rise of a gleaming office district along West Market Street in the 1980s. The first Liberty Place Tower was completed in 1987, breaking the city's height limit, becoming Philadelphia's tallest building. But the late 80s were also the beginning of the crack epidemic, which would decimate struggling neighborhoods that were already reeling from the loss of factory jobs. Most people expected the city's population to keep shrinking. Today, we worry about managing gentrification. But when I returned to Philadelphia in 1999 and started covering architecture, the talk was entirely about managing decline. I frequently heard policymakers question whether it was worth the effort to keep Philadelphia intact as a city. It was very popular at that time to argue that Philadelphia needed to de-densify if it wanted to survive, that it had to tear down its old, obsolete buildings and remake itself on the model of the suburbs. Next slide, please. Andres Duany, the famed New Urbanist planner, gave a lecture to the Foundation for Architecture the year I came back, in which he argued that Philadelphia should designate A streets and B streets. A streets were worth saving, he said, and B streets should be leveled. And I remember one of those B streets, in his view, was Sansom Street. The desire to rebuild Philadelphia on a less dense suburban model was also one of the underlying assumptions of Mayor John Street's signature program, the Neighborhood Transformation Initiative. The idea was to replace the blocks of tightly packed row houses with freestanding homes, complete with lawns and driveways. You can see the result if you go to 13th and Poplar, shown in this photo. This suburb in the city is just four subway stops from City Hall, easily walkable if you're in decent shape. Imagine if this had become the template for all new development. So what happened instead? When I returned to Philadelphia, Ed Rendell was still mayor. In the mid-90s, he had managed to stave off the city's bankruptcy, which was precipitated by the dramatic decline in tax revenues as factories closed and companies left the city. To survive, Rendell knew that Philadelphia needed to replace its lost manufacturing jobs, and he believed that the hospitality industry could provide them. He embarked on a suite of mega projects aimed at turning Philadelphia into a tourist mecca. Next slide, please. We've become so used to the slow creep of incremental, low-budget public improvements here that it's worth recalling the scale of Rendell's ambitions. Convinced that casino gambling would generate a gusher of revenue, Rendell put forward a plan to transform the Delaware waterfront into a Vegas-style shopping mall, bracketed with two sprawling casino complexes. The Philadelphia side would be limited to linked to attractions in Camden by a soaring tram. We've never had a full accounting of what happened, but at least $20 million was put into this effort before it was abandoned. Still, the magical thinking didn't end there. For South Broad Street, Rendell envisioned the creation of Philadelphia's own Great White Way, lined with new theaters and concert halls. In South Philadelphia, the sports complex would be greatly expanded with new stadiums for baseball and football. The empty expanse of Independence Mall would be filled with history museums. Next slide, please. Rendell was a master salesman, and his vision for a renewed Philadelphia excited a lot of people. Philadelphia wasn't the only city to bet the future on tourist attractions and mega projects. Many American cities watched enviously as Baltimore rejuvenated its inner harbor with Camden Yards, the baseball stadium, and a new aquarium. By the late 90s, cities all over the world were in the throes of the Bilbao effect. That Basque city in northern Spain had become a major tourist destination after the opening of Frank Gehry's Guggenheim Museum in 1997. Every big American city wanted its own Camden Yards and its own Frank Gehry building. Philadelphia did end up getting a modern concert hall, some history museums, two new sports stadiums, and of course the Barns. But there were several problems with this way of thinking. For starters, it was largely focused on fixing up the city for people who didn't live here. And because those attractions were geared to suburbanites and tourists, they required huge amounts of parking. They also required money that Philadelphia didn't have, and that caused the city to outsource planning and design decisions to developers and private companies. Next slide, please. As Philadelphia began to rebuild in the early 2000s, parking garages proliferated, just as highways had a generation earlier. Only a single casino was built on the waterfront, and it's the size of a very small Target store. There's no theater, no amenities. Yet the adjacent garage and massive surface parking lot is bigger than the building itself. In my first years as architecture critic, I found myself writing regularly about such parking proposals, partly because there were no other new buildings to write about. Taking his cues from Andres Duany, the new urbanist, one of Rendell's cronies came up with a plan to demolish an entire block of Sansom Street to build a 12-story parking garage. Meanwhile, Rendell enlisted another developer to build a parking garage across from Rittenhouse Square on the site where the Laurel apartment tower is now being built. Next slide, please. Jefferson Hospital demolished a block of 19th century commercial buildings on Sansom Street for a massive parking garage. In the Fairmount neighborhood, Rendell gave away an entire city block for surface parking, or surface parking lot, which remains there to this day. The city spent $50 million to build a parking garage next to 30th Street Station for affluent suburban commuters, but it has yet to muster the money or energy to reopen the underground passage to the Market Frankfurt L, used by city residents. It was hardly my goal to be a reviewer of parking garages, but I felt that the city had its planning priorities painfully backwards. Tearing down structures occupied by people and replacing them with storage units for cars would only make the city less successful. I also couldn't help noticing that many of the developers getting zoning deals, demolishing historic buildings, and building parking garages were some of the most generous campaign donors in the city. became increasingly difficult to write about design without also writing about politics and policy. Next slide, please. I really don't think of myself as being anti-developer. Cities have always been built by private people and companies risking their own money. But because buildings exist in a public context, I've always felt that even quotidian projects like apartment buildings are fair game for review. Some thought I went a little too far in my negative critique of Symphony House on South Broad Street, which is shown in this picture. And as a result, the Inquirer gave special prominence to a rebuttal by the developer. Next slide, please. The story ran on Halloween, so maybe it was the headline that prompted the strong reaction. The headline was Nightmare on Broad Street. I did not write it. At the time, a lot of people saw developers as heroes, and Philadelphia Magazine, as a result of that reaction, ran a full-length story dissecting my review and the response to my review. This was the page in the magazine. And I've always wondered if they would have had the same reaction to my column and written a headline like that if it had been written by a man. But apart from Symphony House's design and the cavernous maw of its Broad Street parking garage, there was one good thing you could say about the building. Symphony House signaled a departure from the tourist-oriented mega projects that the city had been subsidizing. Next slide, please. That tower, finished in 2007, was the beginning of a wave of residential construction that has gone on now for more than a decade, fueled by the tax abatement, which gives buyers of new and renovated homes a significant break on their property taxes for 10 years. Fueled by that tax abatement, more than 15,000 new homes and apartments have been built since 2000, and many more have been renovated. There's little doubt that the abatement helped offset the city's raw edges and convince people who might have otherwise settled in the suburbs to cast their lot with the city. While the tax abatement doesn't deserve all the credit, it did play a role in reversing the city's decline. Next slide, please. The growth has been slow in comparison with Sunbelt cities and places like DC and San Francisco. But since 2010, Philadelphia has grown by 4.3% and added 100,000 new residents. Many of the newcomers have been immigrants, but there's little doubt that millennials and Gen Z have joined them in sizable numbers. What attracted these people were human-scale neighborhoods and the mix of old and new, Philadelphia's walkable streets, its amazing transit options. New slide, please. There's little doubt that the population growth in neighborhoods like Northern Liberties and Queen Village caused City Hall to rethink its planning priorities. The Nutter administration was the first to recognize that rebuilding neighborhoods was the key to the city's future. That period was really the golden age for park building. Next slide, please. The focus on the Delaware finally shifted away from mega projects to parks and trails. The Schuylkill Riverfront Path was extended. I know it's popular now to say that Center City and other affluent neighborhoods were the primary beneficiary of public investment, but the city was also beginning to turn its attention to so-called middle neighborhoods, ones that hadn't been touched by the boom. And during the Nutter era, the city finally started to deal with decades of deferred maintenance. Next slide. It built more than a dozen new public schools. It refurbished its branch libraries, like the imposing neoclassical Marrero branch on Lehigh Avenue, subsidized supermarkets, next, in the city's food deserts, and constructed hundreds of units of affordable housing in North Philadelphia and other neighborhoods. While Philadelphia's poor still cry out for basic neighborhood improvements, particularly parks, rec centers, and housing, it would not be fair to the committed city officials to say that those neighborhoods have been completely overlooked. Next slide. There's no doubt that the revival of the last two decades has made the city more unequal. The more that certain neighborhoods improved, the more they became unaffordable to the people who live there. Take Fishtown and the neighborhood now being called Old Richmond. In 2000, 45% of the apartments were easily affordable by minimum wage workers. Today, less than 7% of those apartments are affordable. Despite the vast makeover of the city's midsection, despite the rise of the Comcast Tower and the birth of a second downtown in University City, almost a quarter of Philadelphia's residents still live in poverty, more than in any of America's 10 largest cities. Gentrification has made historic Black neighborhoods like Graduate Hospital completely unrecognizable. Even worse than gentrification, I would argue, is the dormification of places like North Philadelphia and Mantua. Because there is never enough money to go around, the city has been all too eager to outsource many of its responsibilities to private managers. Everything from charter schools to Dilworth Park, further increasing the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. This is not just a Philadelphia problem, it's a national problem, and we won't solve it on our own. Next, please. I've talked a lot about what Philadelphia has accomplished during these boom times, but it's also important to look at the opportunities that we've squandered. We haven't built a rapid transit line on Roosevelt Boulevard, something that would connect residents in the sprawling Northeast to jobs in Center City. For that matter, we haven't built any new transportation infrastructure, apart from maybe bike lanes. People who can afford to take Amtrak to New York and Washington, who can't afford to take Amtrak to New York or Washington, have to stand outside in the blazing sun and freezing cold to catch the Bolt and Megabus. We also continue to squander our greatest patrimony, our historic buildings. Next slide. Like the next one, please. One more. Yeah, like the Boyd Theater, which was torn down and replaced by a luxury apartment building. But of course, there have been some amazing saves, and the Met Opera House on North Broad Street, a building that languished for decades, is now a vibrant concert hall. Given Philadelphia's struggles with poverty and racism, some might say that the city doesn't have the luxury to bother with design issues. I like to think that my column deals with issues macro and micro that are meaningful to the whole city, not just individual neighborhoods. I also believe that urban form is crucial to creating a more equitable world. Parking lots don't just make nice neighborhoods less walkable. They encourage people to drive, accelerating climate change, which we all know will hit the poor the hardest. We will never be able to support good transit systems and build enough affordable housing if we insist that every house and apartment comes with its own parking spot. The struggles around these issues are only going to become more fraught as a result of the pandemic. Next slide, please. The city will have less money to spend on public improvements, and that will make us even more dependent on private interests. But please don't ask me to predict what the future will bring. I can only offer a small window onto the recent past and the hope that we can all learn from it. Thank you. I believe Andy's going to ask some questions.
Hey, Inga. Thank you for that talk. Let me just move that out of the way. And there are a good number of questions. Mm-hmm. We're just going to go down the line with the ones that have been voted most popular. What is it you think makes Philadelphia unique among American cities?
Well, we have to start with its great history, which, you know, it's one of the original cities of America. It was the Athens of America. It has unbelievable cultural institutions. But we want to take this up to the moment. I think one of the amazing things about Philadelphia and one of its great attractions as a place to live is you can have a fairly dense environment, which can support all kinds of things like, you know, subways and good bus systems. And you can still live in a house, in a row house, which is highly efficient, environmentally friendly. I don't know too many cities in America that have density plus the ability to have a little space of your own. I think that's really special. And, you know, the grid that William Penn and his surveyor gave us makes the city incredibly walkable, bikeable. We have amazing parks, accessible to everyone. It's just about perfect.
I'll have to recommend it. What do you see as the biggest obstacle to helping Philadelphia become a better place for urban dwellers?
You know,
just one.
Excuse me.
Just one.
What is the biggest obstacle? We still want our cake and eat it too. We want to be able to drive everywhere. We don't want to pay the price for that. So we do have a kind of suburban mentality, I would say.
Another question. Do you foresee a flight to the suburbs away from cities due to COVID-19?
I don't. I mean, I think people who are going to move there anyway, for whatever reason, schools or, you know, more space will move there. But, you know, this week, of course, restaurants started to reopen their outdoor tables. And, you know, if you walk around, those tables are full. And all through this pandemic, I have been amazed at how full the parks have been. You know, no shops, no restaurants, no offices. And yet people were really, really using this city. And I think that says a lot, that this city, you know, this city has a lot to offer and people can easily access it. I'm not buying that.
Can you share your perspective on the role of park spaces in Philadelphia? You just did, to a certain extent, and ways they might be improved.
Well, we could always use more money for maintenance of our parks. During this pandemic, I have been spending a lot of time walking through the Penn campus. It's meticulously maintained. They obviously have a lot of money. The city does not. It's and you know, the city parks get a lot, they take a beating. It's hard for the city to keep up. The parks department has never been adequately funded. I'll just make a plug because I believe they're, you know, seeing their budget cut again. And you know, certainly parks in more affluent neighborhoods are better maintained by the city, and they have friends groups that can raise money for them, and there are spaces further afield that need that same TLC.
And speaking of parks, what is your thought about the gathering at 22nd and the Parkway, and how do you think Philadelphia should house the homeless population?
You know, I think it's a worthwhile protest. You know, it forces us to confront this terrible problem that we have, where we are not providing adequate housing for people with the least means. I mean, obviously a lot of those people there have problems beyond the ability, you know, it's not just an inability to pay rent. They probably have substance abuse problems as well, which, or mental illness, which complicates matters. But, you know, we have to you know, we have an obligation to provide housing for everyone in some fashion. So if that protest helps speed that along, it's a good thing.
What is the solution to that problem, though?
That might be making cities. I wish I had the answer, but
or just some inkling in a direction that would be useful.
Well, I think it's obviously, you know, the city is battling the opioid crisis and mental health issues, and we could use more federal money, obviously, to help create the kind of halfway houses and treatment centers that would enable people to return to the workforce and get housing, get decent housing. There are a lot of amazing organizations in Philadelphia that are working on this, and cobbling together all kinds of funding to create, you know, temporary housing for people in need. But the need is so great. And we're not even talking about, you know, just, you know, families that don't have decent housing, that are living in rooming houses or houses where the roof is caving in, you know, people that might have jobs, but really, you know, they're making too little.
Is there an idea from another city that we should steal, that you think we could jump on immediately that would be effective?
You know, I'm not a real expert on this. I mean, we're obviously not the only city with a tremendous homelessness crisis. I mean, if you go to LA, it's probably 10 times as bad as it is here. And Steve Lopez, who used to be a columnist for The Inquirer, has written an amazing series of columns about homelessness in LA. And, you know, there, people who have full-time jobs are living in their cars, and because they can't even begin to afford, you know, like a room in someone's house. One of the things about Philadelphia, I think that needs to be pointed out, because we're always, you know, we're always acting like we're San Francisco or LA or New York with this terrible shortage of affordable housing. We have tons of housing. We have tons of vacant land. What we have is a terrible poverty problem. So, if we could sort of notch down the level of poverty and create jobs, part of that problem would take care of itself, because people would be earning enough to afford the housing that exists. They could fix up houses. It's really wrong to put us in the same basket as San Francisco and LA and Boston and New York. It's just so different here. There's not an actual shortage of housing.
Someone mentions that Philadelphia is one of the most segregated and gentrifying cities. Do you see any good ideas out there in theory or policy or in practice that might make Philadelphia a better place that can support people of all ethnicities and classes? Sort of dovetails with what we were just discussing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that's a true statement. Are we the most segregated, the most gentrified? Definitely
it's
not.
One time, yeah.
Yeah, not the most gentrified by any means. But, you know, I do believe that every neighborhood should have a certain percentage of affordable housing units. And, we can do that, but we have, you know, the city owns a ton of vacant land. And the Philadelphia Housing Authority, you know, which doesn't get as much money as it used to from the federal government, but it has been, you know, bit by bit, very slowly, too slowly, building housing in neighborhoods. That's working in Charswood, which is just north of, I guess you could say, Brewery Town. you know, that's a heavily gentrifying area, brewery town. And so the housing authority is trying to get ahead of the gentrification by building affordable housing first on city-owned land. We could do that in other neighborhoods as well. You know, it's all about money, really. We could theoretically incentivize what they call inclusionary zoning. We do that now, it's voluntary, but we could require, X percentage of units in every development have a few affordable units. Some cities have done that. The argument against doing that here is that our market isn't really strong enough and to support that. And of course, developers rebelled when that was proposed by Councilwoman Sanchez. We could build more densely. I've been a bit critical of the housing authority because they tend to build very low density projects. And I think they are beginning to change. You know, I mentioned that the public housing towers that became so awful. We really went 180 degrees in the opposite direction with our public housing. We began building very low density public housing. It's actually lower density than market rate housing. That's kind of crazy. We should be thinking about building, you know, mid-rise apartments, you know, not giant apartment buildings, but smaller apartment buildings that would be more efficient and cost-effective than individual row houses. It costs the PHA like $400,000 to build a row house. You know, that's not sustainable. So we have to find more cost-effective ways to create affordable housing.
Although interestingly, you mentioned in the book that some of those PHA houses in Hawthorne are going for $500,000. Or were, so I can't remember which other.
Yeah, no, this is true. So this is, you know, this is a problem that's just in Philly, but during the Clinton administration, which started this very, very good program called Hope Six, when they began tearing down all those high-rise public housing towers, you know, the thinking was they were concentrations of poverty and cities would be better off if they had mixed income developments. And so Hope Six encouraged cities to build a mix of units. Some would be, you know, totally subsidized rentals, and others would be subsidized for sale properties. So in the Hawthorne neighborhood, they built these subsidized row houses, and you had to qualify for them. You know, you had to have a low enough income, but you had to have some income. So people bought them for like $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 back in 2000, let's say, 2004. And then the neighborhood turned around, and now those houses are worth $500,000. And after 10 years, you can sell them and get the whole entire profit. So, you know, there's been a lot of criticism in the housing world about, like, well, should the government get some of that, recoup some of that money, since all that public money went into the building them? Should the lucky buyer who got this incredible deal, you know, make a killing on the sale, or should we plow that money back into affordable housing? That's getting probably a little wonky, right?
Into the weeds. You like
into the weeds, yeah.
What demolished building from the last 20 years do you miss the most?
Well, I definitely miss the Boyd Theater. I actually never got to see the Ridge Avenue Farmers Market, but I just love that building. I was very sorry to see this little rec center in Columbus Square demolished recently by the city. That was the round building. It was very charming and quirky. There's a bunch of buildings on Front Street that were, you know, part of the city's original commercial district that have been demolished, a couple more about to be demolished. It's really heartbreaking to see, you know, this unbelievable fabric that's so old and so unique, just kind of wantonly leveled and replaced by parking lots. Still, boom or no boom, they're still making more surface parking lots.
What are we to do with the statues and memorials in the nation that are now seen as offensive?
Yeah, I was afraid I'd be asked this question. So this is, you know, it's a really hard question. I was in Russia, you know, after the breakup of the Soviet Union, and there were graveyards full of Lenin statues. I was thinking we could do like a Garden of the Oppressors. Because we could move them all to one spot, and you know, we could contextualize it and explain what we don't like about them. I recently heard a very good interview with a Black film critic, and she was asked, she was a film historian, she was asked, should the streaming services take down Birth of a Nation, which is a racist film? And she said, no. She said, it should be contextualized. It should be explained. I think she was also talking about Gone with the Wind. And, you know, that's an appealing strategy to me, to contextualize these things. I don't know if that can be done on the sites where they now exist, but in a Garden of the Oppressors.
We could crowdfund that one.
Yeah, we could do it. I was interested and pleased to see that Delaware River Waterfront Corporation is gonna have public meetings to discuss the Columbus Monument at Spruce Harbor Park. Which is becoming quite controversial. And that's a tricky thing, because that monument was designed by Robert Venturi, and it's one of the, you know, few works by one of our greatest architects. So, you know, I kind of hate to see it hauled out of there in the middle of the night. On the other hand, you know, there are a lot of reasons to be offended by it. But I think a process is what's most important, and getting people together to discuss this rather than, you know, scream at each other, I think that might be a better way to go.
How does Philadelphia now compare to the Philly you encountered when you arrived?
So I first moved here in 1985, and I am an ex-New Yorker, and I remember I was looking for a place to live, and I was, you know, people kept telling me, go look at this neighborhood, go look at that neighborhood, and I'd go there, and it'd be so quiet. I can't live here. I can't live here. You know, it was very sleepy. You know, nothing was open at night. There were very, you know, few bars. Dirty Frank's was like one of the only places you could go to hang out. And it was very provincial. It was very, you know, I remember a Republican ward leader knocked on my door and asked me to register as a Republican, and said that if I did, she would get my tickets fixed. And my husband said, well, we don't want our tickets fixed. And she looked at us like, where are you from? What's wrong with you? Of course you should get your tickets fixed. So, you know, there was just kind of this casual attitude about, you know, the law. So, you know, I think Philadelphia's become more sophisticated and interesting and more diverse. And I... you know, it's really, you know, sort of got its mojo back, I think.
Here's hoping it stays. What building do you most currently worry about the most?
From a design point of view?
However you'd like to answer that.
Well, I am very much worried about the tower that was planned for Jewelers Row. You may have read that Toll Brothers is pausing development. So this is like the worst of all possible worlds. I mean, it's a really horrible design. And it's horrible that this incredibly historic ensemble of buildings was gutted in this way. But even worse is the idea that, they tore down these buildings and there could be like an empty lot there for a long, long time. That is just awful.
Ghost of Meridian.
Yeah. Right.
No, please continue if you want to say something.
You know, this is why I focus so much on the Meridian, because, you know, it's pretty mind-blowing that you could have a burned-out building across in the very center of a big city for 8 years. And nobody could get the owners to tear it down. They were waiting for their insurance money. I mean, that's not the only story like that in Philadelphia. There's a building on Rittenhouse Square, that sort of ziggurat one. That was under construction for like more than a decade because, you know, the developer went bankrupt and then it went to another developer and all sorts of things went wrong. I mean, can you imagine like just like a half finished skyscraper just like on Rittenhouse Square for all that time? I mean, so when you asked me before if I thought people would flee Philadelphia because of the pandemic, probably not, but I do worry about a lot of these half-finished projects because, I think people are not going to want to risk their money to finish them. The market's going to be weak. So we could have a lot of very ugly and possibly dangerous construction sites around the city.
Yeah. Well, we don't have a lot of time left, and there's so many questions. I'm almost hesitant to ask you this next one. Please comment on the legacy of Ed Bacon.
You know, it's kind of a mixed legacy, and I think he's actually been rehabilitated, as they used to say, in the Soviet Union. He did a lot of great stuff. I mean, Society Hill is a complicated story, but the positive aspect of it was that it was urban renewal without the destruction. And it showed how a city could be revived without tearing it down. That's an important accomplishment. I think he understood how the pieces went together, how transit the office district and commerce all came together. You know, one of his big, ideas is where the Municipal Services Building is. That's the building where the RZA statue was. When that building was built, and it was built under, when he was the planning director, he linked in the whole transit system into that building, and he understood that these connections are what makes a city successful. We don't really have people thinking that big anymore here or other places. So he really saw how all the parts came together. So I think he deserves a lot of credit for that.
This is a long one. Can city planners, zoning commission, et cetera, institute requirements for planting trees by sidewalks, for example, that would make downtown more walkable in protracted summer months? And then somebody says National Apartments on North 2nd Street has none on the sidewalk, although you deem the design to be admirable.
Right. So I presume city council could mandate it. And there should be more trees. And I think there's a story in the Inquirer today that says it would save hundreds of lives by cooling the city. So it's an important issue. There are some locations where you can't put trees in the sidewalk, at least not in tree pits, because of underground infrastructure. I know a lot of people complained about Lincoln Apartments at Broad and Washington. There's no trees along the Broad Street edge there. That's the black and white striped one building.
Yeah.
And the reason there are no trees there is because it's over the subway tunnel. I mean, now you could, of course, you know, put fairly sizable trees in big pots. And they did put some trees on the plaza there. You know, I can't speak to every location. Like, one of the treeless locations I really hate is the Whole Foods at 22nd Street. You know, that's right, like, part of the parkway, and it's unbelievable there are no trees. There's no greenery at all in front of Whole Foods, of all places. There is a tunnel, I believe, underneath that street. That's become even more awful since they closed the cafe and covered over the windows. Yeah, but yeah, sure, the city could incentivize in various ways the planting of trees. They would have to, you know, hold the developers to it. And, you know, I believe if you have a surface parking lot in Philadelphia, you're supposed to plant shrubbery around it, and then it always dies.
They don't maintain it.
Yeah, they don't maintain it.
Couple of questions, and then we'll have to call it a night. And apologies to all of you who've asked some terrific questions in here. With telecommuting growth in response to COVID, office space will probably be in abundance. Whole Class B buildings could theoretically be converted to affordable housing. Do you envision that happening?
Well, I would say that all the Class B buildings have already been converted. There's almost none left. That happened in the early 2000s as a result of the tax abatement, which was initially aimed just at those kinds of buildings. So now what we have are, I guess, what you would call Class A buildings, like Liberty Place 2, which is partly apartments. Yeah, I mean, anything, you know, towers can be converted to apartments. You need to get the funding to do it. You have to have the will. But sure. I don't know what the first office building to, you know, go is going to be, but yeah, sure.
Okay, last one. I've been struck by the massive destruction of churches and places of worship in Philadelphia. And you've written about this. Mm-hmm. These buildings are visually important to the fabric of the city. What can the city do to protect them despite the decrease of worshipers?
Yeah, so this is, you know, I should have answered this when you asked me the question before about what's the greatest loss, you know, because there's so many unbelievably great churches that are just, you know, hanging on by a thread. You know, we have seen quite a number of them converted to apartments. And, you know, some are converted to offices and other kinds of, you know, spaces. And I think, you know, that's a very good solution. But, you know, unless we all start going to church every Sunday, you know, they're not going to remain houses of worship, unfortunately. But I think we have to be creative about reusing them. I mean, and they're, you know, all over the world, this is a problem in places where people don't go to church like they used to. And you know, we've seen them turn into libraries and, you know, maker spaces and apartments. There have been a lot of successful conversions here. It's what saved many, many wonderful churches. And you get to live in a really interesting space with, like, stained glass windows and high ceilings and interesting woodwork.
There's one down the street from me. It's beautiful. Inga, a number of people here, thank you very much. And I can only second that. Thank you for your good guidance over the years. And we look forward to more of it. Those of you at home, please follow us on Crowdcast. And you can go to our website, freelibrary.org/author events, to find out about our upcoming schedule and upcoming changes to our schedule. Inga, thanks again, everybody. Keep reading.
Thank you, everybody.
Be safe. Take care.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.